And International, as well as a member of the Board of Trustees at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. He has been involved in editing Brother Zafar's book, as well as Imam Al-Asi's tafsir. Please welcome Brother Afif Khan.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah alladhi hada. وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له له الحمد وله الملك يحيي ويميت بيده الخير وهو على كل شيء قدير وأشهد أن محمدًا عبد الله ورسوله وصفيه وخليله أرسله الله للناس نذيرا وبشيرا. Brothers and sisters, committed Muslims, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'd like to echo Brother Muhammad in expressing my gratitude to the organizers, Brother Zafar, the ICIT, and the Islamic Society of York Region, and all of you that are here for entertaining us this weekend and for inviting us to talk about this book, Power Manifestations of the Seerah. I myself, I guess insofar as my contribution to the work is concerned, I helped out in editing the work, verifying some of the historical facts, and adding a small analytical component in certain areas of the book. And in doing the project, again, echoing some of the thoughts that Brother Muhammad said, you'll see that there are very few hadiths in this book. There are some because of the nature of the work, but a lot of it is related to what the Prophet ﷺ did, how he consolidated power, how he acquired it, how he exercised it in a principled way in Mecca and in Medina. The particular context that the book focuses on are the Prophet's letters and treaties. And I don't think that I can stand up here in the few minutes that I have and explain to you every aspect of this book. And so what I'll try to do is focus in on a very small portion of it, an incident out of the life of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and try to help us understand how he executed his role as leader and how he consolidated a group of people around a particular mission in order to disseminate in a practical way the message that was contained in the revelation that he received. And I'm going to try my best not to get emotional or worked up about what I'm going to talk about, because this is not an emotional issue. I'm not here to try to raise your blood pressure and to try to really make you excited about your responsibilities insofar as this deen is concerned. I'm really sort of more concerned about saying something that when you leave this place, you go back and you roll it over in your mind and you think about it. And you try as hard as you can to compare it to the situation in the world that we live in today and measure the approach of the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, to the other power centers and the power culture that exists in the world today. And at the same time, focus in on the treasure that we as Muslims are sitting on with regard to the example and the actions of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, when we mention Islam and Muhammad as words, these words have almost become synonymous with terrorism, oppression of women, public hangings, and a whole litany of other insults and abuses that get tacked on when these words are brought up in the media or they become part of the public discourse. Now, what we are talking about here is a certain public image of Muhammad and of Islam. The reason that I bring this up is that if this is and this was the public image of Islam, why would the people of Medina invite the Prophet to come and help them solve their problems? Why would they invite somebody who's representing a system that's oppressive? Why would they invite somebody who would come in and give them a bad name in the entire peninsula and the entire world? And so, so as far as the people of Medina are concerned, what they did is that they invited the Prophet. They had an idea of what he was talking about in Makkah. And the Prophet ﷺ himself, for 13 years, he was trying to communicate the message of Islam and the message of this revelation to his people. And the people of Medina, they were looking on at what was going on in Mecca. And they were seeing that this message was being rejected by the people of influence in that society. And so they recognized immediately that the Prophet ﷺ is not helping a particular group consolidate their power, increase their power, and then use that power to capture more power or to go out and oppress other people and take their wealth. They saw that his own people rejected him. And so what was important for the people of Medina as they began to come in contact with the message that the Prophet ﷺ was communicating is that rather than taking a look at a practical example of its implementation in society and thereby latching on to something with confidence by seeing it working in front of them, they had to rationalize what he was talking about in their minds. In the beginning, it had to be a mental exercise of confidence building in their minds in order to invite somebody who was rejected by his own people. But this is the key issue here, that he was invited by the people of Medina. The Prophet ﷺ, he didn't go there at the head of an army hoping and trying to execute a dominance of that society. He didn't come there as an oppressor or a king or an emperor. He didn't come there to lay waste to their culture and their society. He didn't come there to exterminate them and then import another stock of his own people from Mecca and have them populate Al-Medina. No, he didn't do any of those things. He was asked to come over there on an invitation. In fact, it could be said that when he actually made the hijrah, he was basically going there in an effort to save his life. Because he could no longer stay in Mecca. But But why did the people in Al-Madinah invite him? Because the Prophet ﷺ put himself in a position where he was invitable by those people. Those people in Medina, they had a problem. They had a generational problem. They were fighting for decades and perhaps centuries. And every now and then, their elders and the people of knowledge would, the power factions of Medina, they would engage in a battle, and all of the elders and the people of knowledge would get killed. And before the Prophet ﷺ went to Al-Madinah, they had, in fact, such an engagement not many years before he went there. And it was called Yawm Al-Bu'ath, where the leaders and the members of the Aws and the Khazraj, they had it out, and they fought each other. With the result that most of their elders and the people of knowledge ended up getting killed. And so these people in Al-Madinah, they wanted to try to put an end to this generational fratricide which was going on in their society. And they were looking for solutions. And so they looked to Mecca, and they saw this man who was talking about establishing a new kind of human culture. And given that Medina was a backwater of Mecca, these people did not have the same, they weren't in the same class as the Quraysh. They weren't regarded to be at the same level economically, politically, socially as Quraysh. You know, they were in a hamlet of Mecca. And so by inviting the Prophet ﷺ, they felt that the message that he was communicating, that it would help them solve this problem. And so these people had a problem, Allah's Messenger had a solution, and they thought that this was a good fit. And so they invited him to come and help them solve their problem. Now let's look at our world today. Have we Muslims put ourselves in a position where if the power culture in the world has a problem in managing its affairs, are we on the short list of people that they're going to call to help them solve their problem? We live in a world today with environmental degradation. We live in a world where millions of refugees are crossing borders. We live in a world where there has been a financial meltdown. We live in a world where the people who have power spend over half their budget in war making. So we live in a world that has problems. But the Muslims are not being called to provide solutions for those problems. That's because we have not put ourselves in a position where we can use the Qur'an and the Sunnah to help the world's people solve their problems. But this is what the Prophet did, and he did it for 13 years. He put himself in a position so that if people sincerely wanted to solve a set of problems, that he was available to publicly communicate the solution to their problems and to be able to provide them a directional course and an implementation program to be able to solve their problem in a practical way. And so he went. The Prophet, he went to Medina. And as all good leaders do, when he got there, he bound the people on a directional course. And this is what good leaders are required to do. They're required to identify the people in the society who are influential and getting other people to follow them. Meaning, he was able to identify the constituencies in that society which could make things work. And so he identified them group by group or tribe by tribe. or power faction by power faction. And at the same time, as he was identifying these groups that could make things happen in Medina, he gave them a unified mission. He created for them a sense of urgency. Because all good leaders, they have the kind of clarity that the rest of the people don't have. And thereby they can communicate a sense of urgency to the people. Because the problems that the Prophet was experiencing in Mecca, they followed him to Al-Madinah. And so the Quraysh, which was a problem for the Prophet in Mecca, became a problem for the people of Medina. And so the mission that the Prophet ﷺ gave to the people of Medina was that they jointly had to manage the security of Medina. He didn't go there and tell them that now that I'm Allah's Prophet to you people, that I'm going to start by telling you that you had to pray 5 times a day, or that you had to fast in Ramadan, and that you had to make Hajj, and that you had to pay the zakah. No, the unified mission that he gave to the society in Medina was that they had together to manage the security of Medina. And that in order to accomplish this unified objective, that they would have to commit to a program, part of which required them to perform certain devotional activities so that they could get close to Allah and thereby solve their problem. And what happens today when somebody goes out and becomes a Muslim? He comes to us Muslims and he says, you know, he wants to become a Muslim. Do we make an assessment of what problems that person is experiencing so that we can provide a useful set of solutions? Or do we say, okay, you know, you're becoming a Muslim, you have to fast, and you have to pray, and you have to give up alcohol, and you have to give up eating pork, and so on and so forth. But that's not what the Prophet did when he got to Medina. He didn't tell them that we're going to burn your houses down if you don't pray. The sense of urgency for them was to manage the security of Medina. Now, as far as the people of Medina were concerned, and the guidance that the Prophet ﷺ was giving them, it became very obvious to them that if one tribe or one power faction, the Aus or the Khazraj or the many other tribes that were there in Medina, that made up the demographics of Medina, it became very clear to them if only one of them committed to the Prophet that they don't have the power and the muscle to deal with Quraysh. That even if two of them got together with the Prophet, that still, in an aggregate sense, they are not going to have the wherewithal to deal with the power and the influence of Quraysh in the peninsula. What they realized, and the wording again, which is used in the Quran, and the wording which is used by the Prophet, is that an ummah was required to deal with the threat of Makkah. An ummah. Now at that time, you know, we're not talking about 2 billion Muslims that form an ummah. We're just talking about the simple city-state of Medina. And yet, the Prophet ﷺ, when he got there, and he began to organize all of these different tribes and power factions into a unified force that would only satisfy one objective, and that was the security of Al-Madinah. And so as far as an ummah is concerned, it's many people working to accomplish one objective. And notice here how we are not saying that all of those people were Muslims that comprised this initial ummah. In fact, the first Islamic ummah was composed almost entirely of non-Muslims. If we take a look at the demographics of Medina at that time, when the Prophet ﷺ got there, we know that he left with some 70-odd people from Mecca, the Muhajirin. And that by the time he got there, due to the work of some of his companions who had preceded him in going to Medina, there were something like between 350 and 500 Muslims in Medina. So altogether, you would say that, you know, roughly speaking, that when the Muhajireen and the Prophet migrated to Medina, that you have about 500 or 600 Muslims. Now, when we take a look at our history books and people attempt to try to figure out the total population of Medina, our historians say that the number is probably somewhere between 6 and 10,000 people who comprised the population of Medina. And most of them agree that it's closer to the higher number, the 10,000. And so now here we have something like 500 or 600 Muslims amongst 10,000 non-Muslims. But Allah's Messenger is referring to all of them as an ummah. Why? Why is he referring to a majority of non-Muslims as part of the Islamic ummah? That is because all of them committed to securing the borders of Medina. And because they made that commitment, it would be only a matter of time that by interacting with the character and the commitment of the Prophet ﷺ, that most of them, by the end of 10 years, in fact all of them, became Muslims. But look at the confidence of Allah's Messenger. He didn't go into that society and suggest that we're going to establish a class structure where the Muslims are on the top and all of the residents of Medina are on the bottom. He didn't suggest that the Muslims had to endorse a non-Muslim so that he could become a Muslim. He didn't give extra rights to the Muslims. In fact, he gave the early Muslims an extra set of responsibilities. But when we take a look at empire in the world today, isn't it just the opposite? Where the rights are reserved for the occupiers, the minority, and all of the responsibilities of work in that society are given to the people, the ones who are oppressed. And so this initial ummah was composed almost entirely of non-Muslims. What does that say to the image of Islam that exists in the world today? There are people out there who are saying that we're not accommodating of non-Muslims. That an Islamic society is oppressive to non-Muslims. And yet here, the first Islamic society is composed almost entirely of non-Muslims. You could ask, you know, how could the Prophet trust non-Muslims to help him manage the security of Medina? They have not even made the kind of commitment that the Muslims had made in Mecca. They hadn't been through the hardship that the Muslims of Mecca had been in. But yet, Allah's Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he trusted these people to help him manage the security of Medina. If I was to put it in today's language, I would say that the Prophet made these different power factions of Medina into represented constituencies of an Islamic society. They became the constituencies of an Islamic society. And by codifying this in writing in the Covenant of Medina, by identifying the constituencies, by identifying their rights and responsibilities, the Prophet ﷺ represented them in the electoral process, in the process of making decisions for that society. Despite the fact that everybody in that society knew that the Muslims and the Prophet at the head of them were coming to be the leaders of that society. They didn't have to choose them as constituencies, they didn't have to represent them. They had the power in Medina. But nonetheless, the Prophet ﷺ distributed that power to people who had not yet become Muslims, and by identifying them in the covenant of Medina, he formalized and legalized the representation. But at the same time, he legitimized his political power in that society. And he legitimized his political power by identifying the important constituencies in that society and by duly representing them in the same way that he represented the Muslims in that society. No favoritism, no preferences, not any of those things. And because of this fairness, this equality, because of this approach that the Prophet ﷺ took, it was only a matter of time before all of these people became Muslims. And so now let's go briefly to the world that we live in today. Because that example that we are talking about with regard to the Prophet, an example of equality, an example of treating people the way that they ought to be treated, an example of no discrimination. Let's see what we can learn by comparing that example to what exists in the world today. Because there is the legitimate and the correct exercise, the just exercise of power, and there is the type of power which is exercised by empires. When people came, Europeans, when they came to settle this hemisphere, and by that I mean the North and the South Americas, they also came as muhajirin. You know, they were European muhajirs that came here to settle this hemisphere. And so by definition, they came as a minority. And there was a majority of native peoples that were here in this hemisphere. What was the approach that they took with the results that we are seeing in the world today? Allah's Messenger involved everybody as an equal constituent in that society. What happened when the European Muhajirs came to the New World over here? Did they recognize the native people as legitimate constituents in a democratic structure? They acquired power by extermination, not by respecting the humanity of all human beings, not by involving them in a decision-making process. And then the next question, were they invited? The European Muhajirin that came here, were they invited to this society? Did they position themselves in the world in a way that they were solving problems for people? And was there a fit between their problem-solving approach and the problems that the peoples, the native peoples, were having in this world? And the answer is no. They came here as conquerors. And they acquired power by extermination, not by cooperation, not by constituency building. And what was the result? That the people who were dominated in that way, to this day, they cannot be represented as equal constituents in the United States or in Canada or in any of the countries in South America. Over 50% of the prison population in the United States is African American. Is that an equal recognition of the humanity of the Africans who were brought here to the New World? Again, the answer is no. And why? Because people within the context of empire are viewed as a source of labor and a source of taxation. They are not viewed as a human resource which can adapt and which can innovate. In the way that the Prophet ﷺ, when he went to Medina, he was taking advantage of the full abilities of the people in that society, regardless of whether they had accepted Islam or not. Because he was confident that if he did things in a just and honorable manner, that all of these people, by the influence of that approach, would ultimately become Muslims. Let us focus in on an example of what it means to be part of an empire, in the way that certain things are said and certain things are done. Because obviously, when we're talking about the Prophet, there's a congruence between words and deeds. And when you're talking about empire, there is a great divide between words and deeds. And so let's just bring this home quickly by talking about the U.S. drone program. Now, all of us have heard and all of us know what these predator drones do in that part of the world where a majority of Muslims live. In one country alone, that's Pakistan, to date, ever since these drones have been employed to drop missiles on top of innocent people with a view, according to them, they're trying to go out and get terrorists, people who would attack the United States. So far, 1,900 people have been killed, and only 56 of them are these so-called high-value targets. So that's a 34-to-1 ratio. For every so-called terrorist that they get, they kill 34 civilians for every terrorist that they get. And we are led to believe, according to their own communications to us, that the CIA and the United States Air Force is going to expand this program, they're going to quadruple this program, and more pilots are going to be trained sitting at their desks, because you know drones don't have pilots. You just operate a drone from a desk sitting somewhere in Nevada or in Boston or New York or somewhere. And because of the satellite technology, you identify your target and you press a button and the drone goes and launches a missile at that target. And so more people are going to be trained in these simulators to run the drones than actual pilots who are going to fly airplanes, US military airplanes. And so we've been told, again, by the spin machines of empire, that the drone program is designed to prevent American servicemen from being killed in the theater of war. And this is what we've been told. Okay, so now let's compare actions. Let's compare words to actions. Where are these drones being used? These drones, right now, they're being used in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, and in Libya. All areas where the U.S. has no ground troops. Or so they at least tell us. They don't have any ground troops. But the so what of using a drone is to protect the U.S. ground troops, to prevent them from getting killed. In the last 40 years, the United States, in its regular aircraft, its F-16s, F-14s, they have not lost a single pilot in a combat mission. In the last 40 years, this is after World War II, not a single U.S. pilot has been lost in a combat mission. And so again, what is the justification? If you haven't lost any pilots, what is the justification for using a drone? You're telling us that we're protecting U.S. servicemen, and for that reason we're employing this new technology. Because it's going to protect U.S. servicemen.
You don't have U.S. servicemen in the field, on the ground, and you don't have U.S. servicemen which are flying these aircraft. Well, what are you protecting? What you're protecting is the commercial interests of the corporations who manufacture this technology. And when we talk about empire, we are talking about a class of people that usurp the resources of the majority of the people and reserve those resources for themselves. And that's not what happened when the Prophet ﷺ equalized the constituencies in all of Medina, where all of them had an equal access to rights, an equal access to resources, and the equal pressure of responsibility. And I'll end with two statements. One by those who rationalize empire, and one a hadith of the Prophet ﷺ describing the responsibilities of leadership in an Islamic society. I'm going to quote this person. His name is Leo Strauss. He's the mentor of people like Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, all those people that you know to be neoconservatives. And so this is what their mentor is saying. In fact, some of these people worked to get their PhDs under him as their advisor. And so he says, those who are fit to rule are those who realize there is no morality, and that there is only one natural right in the universe: the right of the superior to rule over the inferior. This is an expression of empire. And now compare that with a statement of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. Abu Dharr came to the Prophet and he asked him, "Ma kanat suhuf Ibrahim? What are these pages of Ibrahim? What is these texts of Ibrahim?" Of course, you know, these are cited in an ayah in the Quran, the revelation that Ibrahim alayhi salam got. And so Abu Dharr, he wanted to know, and so he's asking the Prophet, "What are these?" And so the Prophet responded to him, and he said, "Kanat amthalan kulluha, wa minha أيها الملك المسلط المبتلى المغرور إني لم أبعثك لتجمع الدنيا بعضها على بعض ولكني بعثتك لترد عني دعوة المظلوم." Okay, so let me try to translate this as best as I can. The Prophet said in response to Abu Dharr's inquiry that the Suhuf Ibrahim were all parables. And a parable basically is an anecdote which has a moral lesson at the end of it. It's not just a narrative, but it's a narrative that has attached to it a moral lesson. And then the Prophet said, and from these parables was the following: "O king who has been imposed, who is exuding vanity, and who is experiencing a degree of tribulation." And again, this is Allah Ta'ala who's talking, because this is contained in the Suhuf Ibrahim. So this is like a revelation to Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. So this is Allah Ta'ala who's talking. And he's saying, "O king who has been imposed," meaning that he was not elected, "who is exuding vanity, and who is experiencing some degree of tribulation." I did not commission you, Allah talking, I did not commission you so that you could gather up the wealth of the world piece by piece. But rather I commissioned you so that you could deflect away from me the dua of the oppressed, the supplication of the oppressed. This is the mission of leadership for any leader in the world. But the objective of empire is to use your power to concentrate wealth. That's what we see going on in the world today. But the objective of just and principled leadership is to take care of the needs of the people who do not have the power to express those needs for themselves.
أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم فاستغفروه يغفر لكم فاسترشدوه يرشدكم والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.